Kevin Randall, a professional writer for nearly three decades with published works that include science fiction, advanced action adventure, techno thrillers, and more than 20 books of nonfiction. Randall has a varied military background and has been decorated in two wars, given his military background and more than 27 years of service. He's considered an expert on military matters and has been called upon by various media agencies for that expertise. He has worked in private industry as a presentations writer for Rockwell International, and he hosted a radio program in El Paso as well, which explored the paranormal. He has studied anthropology at the University of Iowa, psychology at California Coast University, and history with an emphasis on intelligence at the American Military University. He holds four degrees, including a Ph.D. in psychology and a Master of Art of Military Studies. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hey, Kevin, how are you?
I'm just fine, and you?
Excellent. Hey, you know, I was noticing while I was looking at your book, Operation Roswell, your publisher is publishing my very first book, and I did not know that. I didn't put the two and two together. Tor Forge.
Yes.
Well, that's exciting. That's neat. They're good people up there.
Yes, and I've actually been to the offices in New York, and they're in the Flatiron Building, the little triangle building.
And, yeah.
And the publisher just has a marvelous view of Manhattan from that building.
Sure does. Well, I'm going to talk with you later on tonight about Operation Roswell, because that's a topic that just doesn't go away, Kevin, and I want to take advantage of it with you being on the program.
It's fine with me.
Now, sci-fi, I remember years ago you telling me that you were a sci-fi writer and that you had done some work in researching all the sci-fi films, and I said, you know what, that sounds like fun. How did you start doing that?
I always blame my mom for that. Because she was the one that had the interest in science fiction and got me excited about science fiction. So I blame her for my interest in science fiction. And then as you start reading the stories, you realize that science fiction really isn't just gadgets and that sort of thing, but it's really character studies and how people react to very unusual environments. And it's a way of exploring, I guess, our society and what's going on Earth in an arena that takes a little bit away from that sort of emphasis. And that was what Gene Roddenberry, for example, with Star Trek was famous for, is taking events and things attacking our society and moving it into space and looking at it from a little different angle and giving us a chance to kind of explore it from there.
Kevin, Steven Spielberg, great mind, has come up with some great movies. You know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the E.T., the Extraterrestrial, all these films. Where did he get his ideas, his views? Some people say the government kind of leaked things to him. What do you think?
If you go back to The Day the Earth Stood Still, the story was that Robert Wise got the ideas from the government. It was a way of the government to expose the public to the idea of alien visitation in a non-threatening way, so they could make the announcement that they were here. And a lot of the science fiction films that deal with UFOs and alien visitation in a non-threatening way are often accused of having that. I think Steven Spielberg just has a wonderful imagination, and these ideas come to him, and he brings them to the screen.
Well, and he has this certain technique about him, Kevin. Always, first, you know, you'll see a picture of or scene of the night sky. He'll always have like a shooting star go by or something. Always, every movie he has in that genre.
And if you remember, Hitchcock was always in his movies. You just had to look for him.
Right, quick little scene. There he was.
Yes, one of the things that people have talked about is Spielberg's aliens were always.
Nice.
Yeah, nice. I was going to say cute and cuddly.
Right, up until War of the Worlds.
Yes, and that's where I was going, that if you're subscribing to the idea that the government is kind of behind Spielberg's ideas, well, you've got a complete reversal when you get to War of the Worlds. And so he's got aliens that are not benevolent, that are not kind. They've come here to conquer the planet for whatever reason.
And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest Kevin Randall, Operation Roswell. Now, Kevin, this is a science fiction book. It begins at the point most books about Roswell and the government has the flying saucer. It has the bodies of the alien flight crew and so on. Here's my question, because you have investigated Roswell as well. How close is this book, this sci-fi book, to the truth?
What I attempted to do was take what we believed to be the truth about Roswell, the point where they recovered the craft, and what would they have to do to understand what the craft was, how it worked, where it came from, and if there were alien creatures, how they would react to those creatures, what would be the motivation of the government to hide this, and how would they investigate the materials that they recovered there. So I looked at it from the point of view is if Roswell was an actual UFO crash, what would be the next steps beyond the retrieval operation?
Now, you have been investigating Roswell for how long now?
We went to Roswell, I say we, the Center for UFO Studies investigation. We met with people in Roswell in February of 1989. We'd done some preliminary work in the months before that. So 1988 was when I first really got involved in looking at the Roswell case. You know, and frankly, when I first heard about Roswell, I just thought this was the Aztec UFO crash, which came out of Frank Scully's 1952 book, Behind the Flying Saucers. I thought it was just it updated to a new location in an attempt to create the idea of a UFO crash. They're not realizing that this was a different event and that there was actually witnesses we could talk to, people who were involved in this thing, that would corroborate their involvement. So it wasn't like the 1952 Behind the Flying Saucers where there weren't the names of the real people involved. We actually knew who was involved, and we could look at it from that point of view.
When you started investigating Roswell, and of course you heard everything that we've heard today, were you a little skeptical about that, or did you think you were on the way to finding something just pretty far out?
When we set up the first research trip down to Roswell, I thought we would go down there. We'd find a mundane explanation pretty quickly, because the whole idea of a crashed flying saucer had been so thoroughly destroyed in the 1950s with the Aztec thing coming forward, mm-hmm. Frank Scully's book, that almost universally throughout the UFO field, no one accepted these tales of flying saucer crashes. And it wasn't until Len Stringfield started doing his pioneering work collecting these stories and saying, well, maybe there's something to it, we ought to take a look at it. And then, of course, the discovery of Jesse Marcel by Stan Friedman, that we were able to look at this as something more than just one of these urban myth type things where you could never get to the people who were involved. Here was something we could get to the primary people. So when we went down there, I thought we would get to the point we'd talk to the primary people, Bill Brazel, for example, and he would tell us things a little bit differently mm-hmm. than had been reported in the past, and he'd say, well, here's the mundane explanation that makes sense to us. But we got down and started talking to Bill Brazel, and he's talking about these elements from the craft that just do not have any sort of components in the modern world, and saying, yes, this is what happened, and my father was taken to the base at Roswell. And then, of course, we find Edwin Easley, who was a provost marshal, who says, yeah, we had Mac Brazel locked in the guest house here. And we began to corroborate bits and pieces of the story, so it became clear to me that a mundane explanation wasn't going to be readily available to us. And as we got deeper and deeper into it, the mundane explanation seemed to fall by the wayside.
So what do you think, Kevin, in your opinion, happened on that period of 1947 in July?
I think, to my way of thinking, what happened was a crash of an alien spacecraft.
You do, all right.
And it's based on having talked to a number of the people who are involved in it, such as Bill Brazel, such as Edwin Easley, such as Patrick Saunders, the people who were there and in positions of authority and who should have known what was going on at the base at the time. So I think based on that sort of thing, that makes a pretty compelling case for me that it was alien.
The fact, I'll tell you, of all the different episodes that I've read, and I interviewed a couple people a long time ago, and gosh, I can't find those tapes anymore. The Undertaker was one of the most compelling aspects for me. And I know Friedman talked to Marcel, but the Undertaker talking about the need for three little caskets, that was just unbelievable.
But the problem with the Undertaker is he tells us who the nurse was that he knew, and the nurse never existed.
Oh, really?
And to me, and you know, if we'd had this discussion 7 or 8 years ago, I'd have said, yeah, I'm just on board with this thing. But he told us in confidence. He, you know, standing in a hotel room in Roswell, New Mexico, and we say to him, we need the name of the nurse. And he says, well, I promised I wouldn't tell her, but I'll give you guys the name. It was Naomi Self. And then we spend years looking for Naomi Self, and the conclusion we draw based on the research is there was no Naomi Self who was a nurse at the Roswell base.
Why would he make that up?
Because it's a wonderful story. And when we go back and we say to him, Naomi Self, there was no Army nurse ever named Naomi Self. And he says, well, you know, you guys wanted a name. I told you at the time it wasn't the real name, but I said I'd give you a name. And so then he changes the story.
Oh, he changes the story again, which makes it even more suspect. I mean, yeah. But do you have any doubts that somebody contacted him and said, we need three caskets?
I don't think they contacted him. I think they contacted somebody else at the Ballard Funeral Home. And Glenn Dennis worked at the Ballard Funeral Home in 1947. I mean, we can prove that. He's in the city directory as an embalmer at the funeral home. He wasn't a mortician at the time. He later became a mortician,
right.
But he was an embalmer. So clearly he was there. And what I think happened was the guy they actually contacted had told Glenn Dennis this story, and once that guy died, Glenn Dennis took the story as his own.
Okay, all right, that's possible. I can buy that, but it's still a dramatic story all by itself.
Absolutely a dramatic story, but other things that Glenn Dennis told us did not check out. So we're looking at this, and we say, well, that's a marvelous story. Where did it come from?
All right, what about the lieutenant for the military who gave one of the original broadcasts or the radio station owner at the time? Didn't something strange happen there, too? They broadcast this, and then the radio station owner was basically threatened to pull that story?
Walter Haught had gone to the four media outlets in Roswell, Walter Haught being the lieutenant, the base public
right.
affairs officer. And there were four media outlets, two daily newspapers in Roswell, two radio stations in 1947. And so Glenn Dennis, Walter Haught gave that story. The owner of KGFL, the radio station in Roswell, went to Corona and found Mack Brazel, brought him back, and did an hour-long interview with him. What the people who worked at the radio station and the minority owner, Judd Roberts, told us was that they were told by government officials, if they broadcast the interview with Mack Brazel, they had better find new businesses because they would lose their license and they wouldn't be in the radio business anymore. So, yeah, we have, and I have the videotaped interviews with these people telling us these stories. And so we know that some of this stuff went down the way it's been reported. So, yeah, there was phone calls to the radio station telling them not to broadcast their interview with Mack Brazel.
And in those days, government could really have some muscle.
I think in today's environment, and again, the environment today is different than it was in the 1990s, but I think in today's environment, if the government came to a media outlet and said, you know, this story is going to be harmful to national security, I think that the a lot of the reporters and a lot of those outlets would say, okay, we'll sit on this story if you can convince us that's in the interest of national security.
You know,
I think in the 80s and 90s, they would have said, screw you guys.
Yeah, this is probably. You know what's so cool for us? We've been on our station KBIM AM in Roswell for a number of years now. And just the mere fact that we're broadcast into Roswell is kind of cool for us. Because of everything that went down there. What's the latest, though, Kevin? It seems that, you know, the government's come out with a couple stories, far-fetched as they are. Are we ever going to find out what really happened there?
You know that I just did an article in Fate magazine about the latest story which is Nick Redfern claiming that it was some kind of atomic experiment.
Yes, yeah, we had Nick on our show. He believes, that's right, he believes a twofold thing, an atomic experiment and also a Japanese, you know, deformed, they were used in tests. It was a weird story.
Yes, and you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Why do you attach a Horton Brothers flying wing to a Fugo balloon to take these deformed Japanese victims of other experiments into the atmosphere to see how cosmic rays affect them? I mean, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And I had said any number of times that if we could find some sort of an experiment where they'd killed by accident the subjects of that experiment, it would be a story that would get a lot more publicity than the idea of an alien spacecraft. But I looked at the story that Redfern tells, and I did an article for Fate magazine, I think it's the September issue, suggesting here are the flaws in this story as I see it. And so that seems to be the latest, and it just doesn't seem to track with what we know about it. But this goes beyond, well, it was a Project Mogul balloon, which was an experiment to put microphones into the stratosphere type thing, and the other official explanations. The problem I have today in 2005, as opposed to the problem I had in 1995, the witnesses who talked about seeing the bodies, the alien bodies, almost universally, those witnesses have been proven to be telling...
Credible people.
They're not credible people. They're not telling the truth.
They're not.
They're not telling the truth. Frank Kaufman told this marvelous story.
Yeah, I had interviewed him, too, a long time ago.
And Frank Kaufman told us that he'd been a master sergeant. He'd been assigned to intelligence.
Yes, you're right.
And once he passed away, and we got a hold of the original documents, he'd given us copies of his separation materials from World War II. When we got a hold of the original documents, we discovered he hadn't been a master sergeant. He'd been a staff sergeant. His training had all been in the admin field. He had no specialized training.
And he told me in 1996, on tape, which I can't find, that he was one of the first on the scene.
Yes. I've got tapes of him telling those stories, and that he was a member of this group of nine that were the insiders who kind of engineered this whole cover-up. And unfortunately, after he passed away, and I'd done a story in Fate magazine about him around 2000, that, you know, here was where we are on this story, and this is what Frank Kaufman said, and there were little corroborations for his tale. But after that story appeared, then I learned that Kaufman was less than a credible source. And so it seems that almost every person who'd come forward and told us stories of seeing the bodies turned out not to be credible.
All right, yet you still believe that there was a crashed saucer, in spite of all these people who have obviously not enthralled you. You still believe something happened there.
Yes, given some of the other testimonies, given some of the reaction by the government. But I've also learned since then that there's an awful lot of people telling tales about themselves that aren't true. For example, I think of the 1990 census, one of the questions they asked was, you know, are you a Vietnam veteran? And 13 million people said yes, they were Vietnam veterans. And it turns out at the height of the war, the number of American soldiers involved in Vietnam was something like 2.5 million. So, like, only 1 in 9 of the people who claim to be
yeah.
Vietnam veterans, in fact, were Vietnam veterans.
I know it. They embellish.
And at the turn of the last century, there were 15 guys traveling with Carnival saying that they were the real Jesse James. Well, you know, 14 of them had to be lying. And, of course, the 15th was, too, because Jesse James had been gunned down some 20 years earlier. But the point is, I mean, here were guys who were making a living claiming they were the real Jesse James. So people have been... Oh, that's the other thing. I just have this stream of consciousness going here. The last 10 guys to claim to be Civil War soldiers, you know, some of them survived
right.
in the 1950s. The last 10 guys were all liars. They were not Civil War soldiers, and the honor of being the last Civil War soldier goes to a Union drummer boy from the 1860s, who died in 1956.
What do you think of the story of Philip Corso?
Not much.
You don't.
No, it makes no credible sense to me. For example, we
Why would he lie? Do you think he's a? I mean, why would he do that?
Why would anybody lie? It got him the spotlight, the New York Times bestseller.
True.
You know,
true.
And made him a lot of money off that. But I mean, Philip Corso talks about seeing the body, a body at Fort Riley, Kansas, which, by the way, was where we went before we deployed overseas.
Right.
But the story he tells about how he saw the body makes absolutely no sense.
But you believe there were bodies.
Yes. But they didn't go to Fort Riley, Kansas, and Philip Corso didn't see them. I think Corso made the story up. I think what happened was Corso wanted to write a book about his experiences in the military, and he was going to do a book called I Walked with Giants.
Right.
Meaning, here's all the famous people I came in contact with.
Who cares, right?
And there was some small paragraph that mentioned UFOs, and the only thing the publishers were interested in were the UFOs, so he gave them a UFO story.
Well, then it was a darn good one.
It was a fine UFO story, but I don't think it was based in truth.
Well,
and what I know about the way these things work, if they had trucked the bodies to Wright-Patterson,
yeah,
they probably wouldn't have gone through Fort Riley. But even if they did, once the convoy got there, the people assigned to the convoy would have been guarding it, and they wouldn't have had some guy running around the base looking in the boxes to see what was in there.
Okay, but you do believe that we have the bodies. Do you think we still have them somewhere pickled?
You do not destroy unique biological samples.
Well, at least you're not supposed to.
Well, you wouldn't think so. And we do have some interesting secondhand testimony. General Exxon, who was a lieutenant colonel at Wright Field in 1947, talked about friends of his who told him about the bodies. And so we have some interesting information. But the problem is the firsthand testimony we have is all, I think, been proven to be less than credible.
I guess what confuses me too, Kevin, is the confusion over the crash material. You would think that if you saw something that was crashed like that, you'd be able to figure out what it is. Then again, look, we still have people arguing the merits of whether a plane hit the Pentagon or not based on the fact that you really can't see plane parts. So who knows? I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment. Well, let's go first-time caller line. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir. It's you.
Hi, George.
Hi.
This is Eddie from California.
Hello, Eddie.
I love your show.
Thank you, sir.
I have an experience that I had about 7 years ago.
What happened?
And I was going to bed, and usually all my life I slept on my left side. And that night I was on my right side, and suddenly I wanted to turn to my left side, and my body just paralyzed. Then I wanted to turn to the other side, I couldn't, and suddenly I opened my eyes, and I saw this four-foot entity. It's kind of like gray, transparent. The face was like square, and the eyes, a little bit like kind of like the ants.
Like ants?
Like the ants, like insects.
Huh.
So he was standing by my feet and looked at me, and I was looking at him with no fear. And I couldn't talk to him, and it's just like asking what he wants.
Eddie, you think it was like an alien visitation on you?
Yes, sir. Because I was totally aware, because I just want to move to my left side and sleep, and I couldn't.
Kevin, do you get into that at all in any of your work?
Well, of course, there's the alien abduction phenomenon that people talk about, but there's also another phenomenon known as sleep paralysis,
which is
quite common.
And you know, and really medical.
And the problem that we have with research today is we have not figured out a way to tell sleep paralysis from an alien abduction, and we have to figure out how to do that so that we can make some legitimate and logical choices. But it could be an episode of sleep paralysis. It could be something else.
Good point. Let's move to our international line. Where are you calling from? You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Kevin, this is Keith. I'm calling from the Valley of the Trinidad.
Well, hello there, Keith, in Mexico. I hope you're not getting blasted by these tropical storms and would-be hurricanes.
I'm not worried about it, but it's coming right up. It'll probably be up here Thursday. It'll probably be here Thursday with us,
right
where I'm at.
We'll be safe. Go ahead.
But What I want to, I'm going to try to help you as much as I can, Kevin, because George, he had a guy on his program here a while back, Brian, up in California that I was working with. He wanted to do a book, and I told him, a story of who I am and, about the Roswell incident because I was involved in that thing absolutely directly. There was two people, and there was three craft, and the three craft came here for one reason, and that was to return five people back to their planet. And in the meantime, they were trying to make communications with the American authorities, the government authorities, and they weren't interested in anything but the technology for weapons of war. And so they decided to escape, and when they went to escape, they were basically shot down. One went down in Roswell. The other one went down to Four Corners area. The third one went down up in Alaska.
Who shot them down?
They scrambled some planes, some American fighter planes, and they shot them down. They shot all three of them. Two of them were damaged. One of them was damaged bad, went down right at Roswell. The other one made it as far as the Four Corners up there in the United States, and third one went down up in Idaho and made some repairs and then went on and went down up in Alaska. I can supply you with documents and everything on this whole thing. I have documents. I have a diary I have personally kept on this for many years. I can put you in contact with Byron, and he has a lot of the information I've given him. And I myself, personally, I have been in hiding for many years because your government wants me extremely bad.
Kevin, do you want this info, I guess?
Well, we need to take a look at it, certainly.
So I guess, can he get your address via your website?
He can make...
How do you want to do this?
I tried to get his address and any way to contact him, and I can't find anything on his website at all.
Well, I'll tell you what. I will. Hold on. I will put you on hold, and you can give Tom your information. Tom, you get it to Kevin. You want to do it that way, Kevin?
Well, I was going to say he could initiate the contact by hitting my email address, which is simply krandall993@aol.com, and then we can work it out from there.
Okay, we'll do it that way, and. Keith, we'll let you work it out that way. If you have any problems, get back to us. But I'll also have Tom take your call. And pick that up, Tom, on line six. He's got it. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Carol from Willow Creek, California.
Hi, Carol.
This is Bigfoot Country.
Sure is.
And I'm listening to you on my Free Play Plus coming out of Portland. On
KEX.
Yeah, KEX. It's the only station I can get you on because I'm in the Little Valley.
Little Valley. I'm down in the valley.
Yeah.
All right.
Anyhow, ahead. Hi, and hi, Kevin. One, I had a comment regarding Roswell, and then I had a question about a science fiction movie. The comment about Roswell, you said there was no such nurse that you could find anything about. And some of the information that you had that was supposed to be firsthand that turned out not to be actually factual. Well, isn't it possible that the U.S. military also changed things to get rid of things, or they can get rid of people also so that information would look like it was bogus?
The problem with that is there's all kinds of alternative places to look for information.
Oh.
And we were given very specific information about where she was and where she came from. And one of the things that Glenn Dennis said, that she'd been killed in a plane crash in the killed five Army nurses shortly after this event took place. And I went through the New York Times Index, which lists all the aircraft accidents and could find no such plane crash. I think Don Berliner looked in the Stars and Stripes, which is a military-oriented newspaper for people serving overseas, and while you could make a case that they may have expunged her military record for whatever reason, none of the ancillary information ever checked out either, and they just can't do that. They cannot take away everything. So if there had been a plane crash that had killed the Army nurses, there would have been a record of it somewhere, and we could find nothing like that. So there's all these sorts of things that led to the conclusion that the nurse didn't exist. And when we went to Glenn Dennis and we said, no, there was never any Army nurse named Naomi Self, he said to us, I didn't give you the right name. And at that point, we're back to ground zero. So we'd spent years searching for a specific nurse with a specific name, and once we said to him there was no such nurse, he changed the story. That does not bode well.
Yeah, that's true.
Hey, Kevin, thanks for bringing us down memory lane with the sci-fi flicks.
Oh, no problem.
I appreciate it. Take care. You have a good night, Major.
Thank you.
It's Major Kevin Randall. His websites, of course, are linked up to his name at coasttocoastam.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow night as we get the rest of the week rolling right here on Coast to Coast. For Karis Coburn, Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.